If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. With Ramp, you get full visibility into your company's spending and control who spends what with each vendor. Ramp's software collects and verifies receipts instantly to save your team valuable time. Ramp automates data entry and routine tasks with automated approvals, expense categorization and bill payments, time-consuming tasks, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. Get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
Section 7 of Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Volume 2, by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, translated by Thomas Carlyle. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Book 7, Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Chapter 1. Spring had come in all its brilliancy. A storm that had been lowering all day went fiercely down upon the hills. The rain drew back into the country. The sun came forth in all its splendour, and upon the dark vapour rose the lordly rainbow. Wilhelm was riding toward it. The sight made him sad. "Ah," said he within himself, "must it be that the fairest hues of life appear to us only on a ground of black? And must drops fall if we are to be enraptured? A bright day is like a dull day, if we look at it unmoved. And what can move us but some silent hope that the inborn inclination of our soul shall not always be without an object? The recital of a noble action moves us. The sight of everything harmonious moves us. We feel then as if we were not altogether in a foreign land. We fancy we are nearer the home toward which our best and inmost wishes impatiently strive." Meanwhile a pedestrian overtook him, and walking with a stout step by the side of the horse, began to keep him company. After a few common words, he looked at the rider and said, "If I am not mistaken, I must have already seen you somewhere." "I too remember you," said Wilhelm. "Had we not some time ago a pleasant sail together?" "Right," replied the other. Wilhelm looked at him more narrowly, then, after a pause, observed, "I do not know what alteration has occurred in you. Last time we met I took you for a Lutheran country clergyman. You now seem to me more like a Catholic priest." "Today at least you are not wrong," replied the other, taking off his hat and showing him the tonsure. "Where is your company gone? Did you stay long with them?" "Longer than was good. On looking back upon the period which I passed in their society, it seems as if I looked into an endless void. Nothing of it has remained with me." "Here you are mistaken," said the stranger. "Everything that happens to us leaves some trace behind it. Everything contributes imperceptibly to form us. Yet often it is dangerous to take a strict account of that, for either we grow proud and negligent, or downcast and dispirited, and both are equally injurious in their consequences. The safe plan is always simply to do the task that lies nearest us, and this in the present case, added he with a smile, is to hasten to our quarters. Wilhelm asked how far Lothario's house was distant. The stranger answered that it lay behind the hill. "Perhaps I shall meet you there," continued he. "I have merely a small affair to manage in the neighbourhood. Farewell till then," and with this he struck into a steep path that seemed to lead more speedily across the hill. "Yes, the man is right," said Wilhelm to himself as he proceeded. "We should think of what is nearest, and for me at present there is nothing nearer than the mournful errand I have come to do. Let me see if I can still repeat the speech, which is to put that cruel man to shame." He then began reciting to himself this piece of oratory. Not a syllable was wanting, and the more his recollection served him, the higher grew his passion and his courage. Aurelia's sorrows and her death were vividly present to his soul. "Spirit of my friend," exclaimed he, "hover around me, and if thou canst, give some sign to me that thou art softened, art appeased." Amid such words and meditations he had reached the summit of the hill, and near the foot of its declivity he now beheld a curious building which he at once took to be Lothario's dwelling. An old irregular castle with several turrets and peaked roofs appeared to have been the primitive erection, but the new additions to it placed near the main structure looked still more irregular. A part of them stood close upon the main edifice, others at some distance were combined with it by galleries and covered passages. All external symmetry, every shade of architectural beauty, appeared to have been sacrificed to the convenience of the interior. No trace of wall or trench was to be seen, none of avenues or artificial gardens. A fruit and pot-herb garden reached to the very buildings, and little patches of a like sort showed themselves even in the intermediate spaces. A cheerful village lay at no great distance. The fields and gardens everywhere appeared in the highest state of cultivation. Sunk in his own impassioned feelings, Wilhelm rode along, not thinking much of what he saw. He put up his horse at an inn, and not without emotion hastened to the castle. An old serving man received him at the door, and signified with much good nature that today it would be difficult to get admission to his lordship, who was occupied in writing letters, and had already refused some people that had business with him. Our friend became more importunate. The old man was at last obliged to yield and announce him. He returned and conducted Wilhelm to a spacious ancient hall, desiring him to be so good as wait, since perhaps it might be some time before his lordship could appear. Our friend walked up and down unrestfully, casting now and then a look at the knights and dames whose ancient figures hung around him on the walls. He repeated the beginning of his speech. It seemed, in presence of these ruffs and coats of mail, to answer even better. Every time there rose any stir, he put himself in posture to receive his man with dignity, meaning first to hand him the letter, then assail him with the weapons of reproach. More than once mistaken, he was now beginning to be really vexed and out of tune, when at last a handsome man in boots and light surtout stepped in from a side door. "What good news have you for me?" said he to Wilhelm, with a friendly voice. "Pardon me that I have made you wait." So speaking, he kept folding a letter which he held in his hand. Wilhelm, not without embarrassment, delivered him Aurelius' paper, and replied, "I bring you the last words of a friend which you will not read without emotion." Lothario took it and returned to his chamber with it, whereas Wilhelm through the open door could very easily observe he addressed and sealed some letters before opening Aurelia's. He appeared to have perused it once or twice, and Wilhelm, though his feelings signified that the pathetic speech would sort but ill with such a cool reception, girded up his mind, went forward to the threshold, and was just about beginning his address, when a tapestry door of the cabinet opened and the clergyman came in. "I have got the strangest message you can think of," cried Lothario to him. "Pardon me," continued he, addressing Wilhelm, "if I am not in a mood for speaking further with you at this moment. You remain with us to-night. You, Abbé, see the stranger properly attended to." With these words he made his guest a bow. The clergyman took Wilhelm by the hand, who followed, not without reluctance. They walked along some curious passages in silence, and at last reached a very pretty chamber. The abbé led him in, and then left him, making no excuses. Ere long an active boy appeared, He introduced himself as Wilhelm's valet and brought up his supper. In waiting he had much to say about the order of the house, about their breakfasting and dining, labours and amusements, interspersing many things in commendation of Lothario. Pleasant as the boy was, Wilhelm endeavoured to get rid of him as soon as possible. He wished to be alone, for he felt exceedingly oppressed and straitened in his new position. He reproached himself with having executed his intention so ill, with having done his errand only half. One moment he proposed to undertake next morning what he had neglected to-night. The next he saw that, by Lothario's presence, he would be attuned to quite a different set of feelings. The house, too, where he was, seemed very strange to him. He could not be at home in his position. Intending to undress, he opened his travelling bag. With his night clothes he took out the spirit's veil, which Mignon had packed in along with them. The sight of it increased the sadness of his humour. "Flee, youth, flee!" cried he. "What means this mystic word? What am I to flee, or whither? It were better had the spirit called to me, return to thyself!" He cast his eyes on some English copper plates hung round the room in frames. Most of them he looked at with indifference. At last he met with one in which a ship was represented sinking in a tempest. A father with his lovely daughters was awaiting death from the intrusive billows. One of the maidens had a kind of likeness to the Amazon. An indescribable compassion seized our friend. He felt an irresistible necessity to vent his feelings. Tears filled his eyes. He wept, and did not recover his composure till slumber overpowered him. Strange dreams arose upon him toward morning. He was in a garden which in boyhood he had often visited. He looked with pleasure at the well-known alleys, hedges, flower-beds. Mariana met him. He spoke to her with love and tenderness, recollecting nothing of any bygone grievance. Ere long his father joined them in his weekday dress. With a look of frankness that was rare in him, he bade his son fetch two seats from the garden-house, then took Mariana by the hand and led her into a grove. Wilhelm hastened to the garden-house, but found it altogether empty. Only at a window in the farther side he saw Aurelia standing. He went forward and addressed her, but she turned not round, and though he placed himself beside her, he could never see her face. He looked out from the window. In an unknown garden there were several people, some of whom he recognised. Frau Melina, seated under a tree, was playing with a rose which she had in her hand. Laertes stood beside her, counting money from the one hand to the other. Mignon and Felix were lying on the grass, the former on her back, the latter on his face. Filina came and clapped her hands above the children. Mignon lay unmoved. Felix started up and fled. At first he laughed while running as Filina followed. Then he screamed in terror when he saw the harper coming after him with large, slow steps. Felix ran directly to a pond. Wilhelm hastened after him. Too late, the child was lying in the water. Wilhelm stood as if rooted to the spot. The fair Amazon appeared on the other side of the pond. She stretched her right hand toward the child and walked along the shore. The child came through the water by the course her finger pointed to. He followed her as she went round. At last she reached her hand to him and pulled him out. Wilhelm had come nearer. The child was all in flames. Fiery drops were falling from his body. Wilhelm's agony was greater than ever, but instantly the Amazon took a white veil from her head and covered up the child with it. The fire was at once quenched. But when she lifted up the veil, two boys sprang out from under it, and frolicsomely sported to and fro, while Wilhelm and the Amazon proceeded hand in hand across the garden, and noticed in the distance Mariana and his father, walking in an alley, which was formed of lofty trees, and seemed to go quite round the garden. He turned his steps to them, and with his beautiful attendant, was moving through the garden, when suddenly the fair-haired Friedrich came across their path, and kept them back with loud laughter and a thousand tricks. Still, however, they insisted on proceeding, and Friedrich hastened off, running toward Mariana and the father. These seemed to flee before him. He pursued the faster till Wilhelm saw them hovering down the alley almost as on wings. Nature and inclination called on him to go and help them, but the hand of the Amazon detained him. How gladly did he let himself be held! With this mingled feeling he awoke, and found his chamber shining with the morning beams. Chapter 2. Our friend was called to breakfast by the boy. He found the abbé waiting in the hall. Lothario, it appeared, had ridden out. The abbé was not very talkative, but rather wore a thoughtful look. He inquired about Aurelia's death, and listened to our friend's recital of it with apparent sympathy. Ah, cried he, the man that discerns with lively clearness what infinite operations art and nature must have joined in before a cultivated human being can be formed. The man that himself as much as possible takes interest in the culture of his fellow men, is ready to despair when he sees how lightly mortals will destroy themselves, will blamelessly or blamably expose themselves to be destroyed. When I think of these things, life itself appears to me so uncertain a gift that I could praise the man who does not value it beyond its worth. Scarcely had he spoken when the door flew violently up. A young lady came rushing in. She pushed away the old servant who attempted to restrain her. She made right to the abbé and seized him by the arm. Her tears and sobs would hardly let her speak these words. Where is he? Where have you put him? 'Tis a frightful treachery. Confess it now. I know what you are doing. I will after him, will know where you have sent him. Be calm, my child, replied the abbé with assumed composure. Come with me to your room. You shall know it all. Only you must have the strength to listen if you ask me to relate. He offered her his hand as if he meant to lead her out. I will not return to my room, cried she. I hate the walls where you have kept me prisoner so long. I know it already. The colonel has challenged him. He has gone to meet his enemy. Perhaps this very moment he... Once or twice I thought I heard the sound of shots. I tell you, order out a coach and come along with me, or I will fill the house and all the village with my screaming. Weeping bitterly, she hastened to the window. The abbé held her back and sought in vain to soothe her. They heard a sound of wheels. She threw up the window, exclaiming, "He is dead! They are bringing home his body!" "He is coming out," replied the abbé. "You perceive he lives." "He is wounded," said she wildly, "else he would have come on horseback. They are holding him. The wound is dangerous." She ran to the door and down the stairs. The abbé hastened after her, and Wilhelm, following, observed the fair one meet her lover, who had now dismounted. Lothario leaned on his attendant, whom Wilhelm at once knew as his ancient patron, Jarno. The wounded man spoke very tenderly and kindly to the tearful damsel. He rested on her shoulder, and came slowly up the steps, saluted Wilhelm as he passed, and was conducted to his cabinet. Jarno soon returned, and going up to Wilhelm, "It appears," said he, "you are predestined everywhere to find a theatre and actors. We have here commenced a play which is not altogether pleasant." "I rejoice to find you," answered Wilhelm, "in so strange an hour. I am astonished, frightened, and your presence already quiets my mind. Tell me, is there danger? Is the Baron badly wounded?" "I imagine not," said Jarno. It was not long till the young surgeon entered from the cabinet. "Now what say you?" cried Jarno to him. "That it is a dangerous piece of work," replied the other, putting several instruments into his leathern pouch. Wilhelm looked at the band, which was hanging from the pouch. He fancied he knew it. Bright, contrary colours, a curious pattern, gold and silver wrought in singular figures, marked this band from all the bands in the world. Wilhelm was convinced he beheld the very pouch of the ancient surgeon who had dressed his wounds in the green of the forest. And the hope, so long deferred, of again finding traces of the lovely Amazon, struck like a flame through all his soul. "Where did you get that pouch?" cried he. "To whom did it belong before you? I beg of you, tell me." "I bought it at an auction," said the other. "What is it to me whom it belonged to?" So speaking, he went out, and Jarno said, "If there would come but one word of truth from our young doctor's mouth." "Then he did not buy the pouch?" said Wilhelm. "Just as little as Lothario is in danger," said the other. Wilhelm stood, immersed in many reflections. Jarno asked how he had fared of late. Wilhelm sketched an outline of his history, and when he at last came to speak of Aurelia's death and his message to the place, his auditor exclaimed, "Well, it is strange, most strange." The abbé entered from Lothario's chamber, beckoned Jarno to go in instead of him, and said to Wilhelm, "The Baron bids me ask you to remain with us a day or two, to share his hospitality, and in the present circumstances contribute to his solacement. If you need to give any notice to your people, your letter shall be instantly dispatched. Meanwhile, to make you understand this curious incident, of which you have been witness, I must tell you something which indeed is no secret. The Baron had a small adventure with a lady, which excited more than usual attention. The lady having taken him from a rival, and wishing to enjoy her victory too ostentatiously. After a time he no longer found the same delight in her society, which he of course forsook, but being of a violent temper, she could not bear her fate with patience. Meeting at a ball, they had an open quarrel. She thought herself irreparably injured, and would be revenged. No knight stepped forth to do battle for her, till her husband, whom for years she had not lived with, heard of the affair and took it up. He challenged the baron, and to-day he has wounded him. Yet, as I hear, the gallant colonel has himself come still worse off. From this hour our friend was treated in the house as if he had belonged to it. Chapter 3. At times they had read a little to the patient. Wilhelm joyfully performed this service. Lydia stirred not from Lothario's bed. Her care for him absorbed her whole attention. But today the patient himself seemed occupied with thought. He bade them lay aside their book. "Today," said he, "I feel through my whole heart how foolishly we let our time pass on. How many things have I proposed to do, how many have I planned, yet how we loiter in our noblest purposes. I have just read over the scheme of the changes which I mean to make in my estates, and it is chiefly, I may say, on their account that I rejoice at the bullets not having gone a deadlier road." Lydia looked at him with tenderness, with tears in her eyes, as if to ask if she, if his friends, could not pretend to any interest in his wish to live. Jarno answered, "Changes such as you project require to be considered well on every side before they are resolved on." "Long considerations," said Lothario, "are commonly a proof that we have not the point to be determined clearly in our eye, precipitate proceedings, that we do not know it. I see distinctly that in managing my property there are several particulars in which the services of my dependents cannot be remitted, certain rights which I must rigidly insist on. But I also see that there are other articles, advantageous to me, but by no means indispensable, which might admit of relaxation. Do I not profit by my lands far better than my father did? Is not my income still increasing? And shall I alone enjoy this growing benefit? Shall not those who labour with and for me partake, in their degree, of the advantages which expanding knowledge, which a period of improvement, are procuring for us?" "'Tis human nature," cried Jarno. "I do not blame myself when I detect this selfish quality among the rest. Every man desires to gather all things round him, to shape and manage them according to his own pleasure. The money which he himself does not expend, he seldom reckons well expended." "Certainly," observed Lothario, "much of the capital might be abated if we consumed the interest less capriciously." "The only thing I shall mention," said the other, "the only reason I can urge against your now proceeding with those alterations, which, for a time at least, must cause you loss, is that you yourself are still in debt, and that the payment presses hard on you. My advice is, therefore, to postpone your plan till you are altogether free. And in the meanwhile leave it at the mercy of a bullet, or the fall of a tile, to annihilate the whole result of my existence and activity. Oh, my friend, it is ever thus. It is ever the besetting fault of cultivated men, that they wish to spend their whole resources on some idea, scarcely any part of them on tangible existing objects. Why was it that I contracted debts, that I quarrelled with my uncle, that I left my sisters to themselves so long? Purely for the sake of an idea. In America I fancied I might accomplish something. Overseas I hoped to become useful and essential. If any task was not begirt with 1,000 dangers, I considered it trivial, unworthy of me. How differently do matters now appear! How precious, how important seems the duty which is nearest me, whatever it may be!" "I recollect the letter which you sent me from the Western world," said Jarno. "It contains the words, 'I will return, and in my house, amid my fields, among my people, I will say, here or nowhere is America.'" "Yes, my friend, and I am still repeating it, and still repining at myself that I am not so busy here as I was there. For certain equable, continuous modes of life, there is nothing more than judgment necessary, and we study to attain nothing more, so that we become unable to discern what extraordinary services each vulgar day requires of us, or if we do discern them, we find abundance of excuses for not doing them. A judicious man is valuable to himself, but of little value for the general whole." "We will not," said Jarno, "bear too hard upon judgment. Let us grant that, whenever extraordinary things are done, they are generally foolish." "Yes, and just because they are not done according to the proper plan. My brother-in-law, you see, is giving up his fortune, so far as in his power, to the community of Herrnhut. He reckons that by doing so he is advancing the salvation of his soul. Had he sacrificed a small portion of his revenue, he might have rendered many people happy, might have made for them and for himself a heaven upon earth. Our sacrifices are rarely of an active kind. We, as it were, abandon what we give away. It is not from resolution, but despair that we renounce our property. In these days, I confess it, the image of the Count is hovering constantly before me. I have firmly resolved on doing from conviction what a crazy fear is forcing upon him. I will not wait for being cured. Here are the papers. They require only to be properly drawn out. Take the lawyer with you. Our guest will help. What I want you know as well as I. Recovering or dying, I will stand by it and say, here or nowhere is Herrnhut. When he mentioned dying, Lydia sank before his bed. She hung upon his arm and wept bitterly. The surgeon entered. Jarno gave our friend the papers and made Lydia leave the room. "For heaven's sake, what is this about the Count?" cried Wilhelm, when they reached the hall and were alone. "What Count is it that means to join the Herrnhuters?" "One whom you know very well," said Jarno. "You yourself are the ghost who have frightened the unhappy wiseacre into piety. You are the villain who have brought his pretty wife to such a state that she inclines accompanying him." "And she is Lothario's sister," cried our friend. "No other, and Lothario knows the whole." "Oh, let me fly," cried Wilhelm. "How shall I appear before him? What can he say to me?" "That no man should cast a stone at his brother, that when one composes long speeches with a view to shame his neighbours, he should speak them to a looking-glass." "Do you know that too?" "And many things besides," said Jarno with a smile. "But in the present case," continued he, "you shall not get away from me so easily as you did last time. You need not now be apprehensive of my bounty money. I have ceased to be a soldier. When I was one, you might have thought more charitably of me. Since you saw me, many things have altered. My prince, my only friend and benefactor, being dead, I have now withdrawn from busy life and its concerns. I used to have a pleasure in advancing what was reasonable. When I met with any despicable thing, I hesitated not to call it so. And men have never done with talking of my restless head and wicked tongue. The herd of people dread sound understanding more than anything. They ought to dread stupidity, if they had any notion what was really dreadful. Understanding is unpleasant, they must have it pushed aside. Stupidity is but pernicious, they can let it stay. Well, be it so. I need to live. I will by and by communicate my plans to you. If you incline, you shall partake in them. But tell me first how things have gone with you. I see, I feel that you are changed. How is it with your ancient maggot of producing something beautiful and good in the society of gypsies?" "Do not speak of it," cried Wilhelm. "I have been already punished for it. People talk about the stage, but none that has been upon it can form the smallest notion of it. How utterly these men are unacquainted with themselves, how thoughtlessly they carry on their trade, how boundless their pretensions are, no mortal can conceive. Each would be not only first, but sole. Each wishes to exclude the rest, and does not see that even with them he can scarcely accomplish anything. Each thinks himself a man of marvellous originality, yet with a ravening appetite for novelty, he cannot walk a footstep from the beaten track. How vehemently they counterwork each other! It is only the pitifulest self-love, the narrowest views of interest, that unite them. Of reciprocal accommodation they have no idea. Backbiting and sudden spitefulness maintain a constant jealousy among them. In their lives they are either rakes or simpletons. Each claims the loftiest respect, each writhes under the slightest blame. All this he knew already, he will tell you. Why then did he not do it? Ever needy, ever unconfiding, they seem as if their greatest fear were reason and good taste, their highest care to secure the majesty of their self-will." Wilhelm drew breath, intending to proceed with his eulogium, when an immoderate laugh from Jarno interrupted him. "Poor actors," cried he, threw himself into a chair and laughed away. "Poor dear actors!" "Do you know, my friend," continued he, recovering from his fit, "that you have been describing not the playhouse but the world, that out of all ranks I could find you characters and doings in abundance to suit your cruel pencil? Pardon me, it makes me laugh again, that you should think these amiable qualities existed on the boards alone." Wilhelm checked his feelings. Jarno's extravagant, untimely laughter had in truth offended him. "It is scarcely hiding your misanthropy," said he, "when you maintain that faults like these are universal." and it shows your unacquaintance with the world when you impute them to the theatre in such a heinous light. I pardon in the player every fault that springs from self-deception and the desire to please. If he seem not something to himself and others, he is nothing. To seem is his vocation. He must prize his moment of applause, for he gets no other recompense. He must try to glitter. He is there to do so. You will give me leave at least to smile in my turn, answered Wilhelm. I should never have believed that you could be so merciful, so tolerant. I swear to you I am serious, fully and deliberately serious. All faults of the man I can pardon in the player. No fault of the player can I pardon in the man. Do not set me upon chanting my lament about the latter. It might have a sharper sound than yours. The surgeon entered from the cabinet, and to the question how his patient was, he answered with a lively air of complacence, "Extremely well, indeed. I hope soon to see him quite recovered." He hastened through the hall, not waiting Wilhelm's speech, who was preparing to inquire again with greater importunity about the leathern case. His anxiety to gain some tidings of his Amazon inspired him with confidence in Jarno. He disclosed his case to him, and begged his help. "You that know so many things," said he, "can you not discover this?" Jarno reflected for a moment, then turning to his friend, "Be calm," said he, "give no one any hint of it. We shall come upon the fair one's footsteps, never fear. At present I am anxious only for Lothario. The case is dangerous. The kindliness and comfortable talking of the doctor tells me so. We should be quit of Lydia, for here she does no good. But how to set about the task I know not. Tonight I am looking for our old physician. We shall then take further counsel." Chapter 4. The physician came. It was the good old little doctor whom we know already, and to whom we were obliged for the communication of the pious manuscript. First of all, he visited the wounded man, with whose condition he appeared to be by no means satisfied. He had next a long interview with Jarno, but they made no allusion to the subject of it when they came to supper. Wilhelm saluted him in the kindest manner and inquired about the harper. "We have still hopes of bringing round the hapless creature," answered the physician. "He formed a dreary item in your limited and singular way of life," said Jarno. "How has it fared with him? Tell me." Having satisfied Jarno's curiosity, the physician thus proceeded, "I have never seen another man so strangely circumstanced. For many years he has not felt the smallest interest in anything without him, scarcely paid the smallest notice to it. Wrapped up in himself, he has looked at nothing but his own hollow, empty me, which seemed to him like an immeasurable abyss. It was really touching when he spoke to us of this mournful state. 'Before me,' he cried, 'I see nothing. Behind me nothing but an endless night, in which I live in the most horrid solitude. There is no feeling in me but the feeling of my guilt, and this appears but like a dim, formless spirit, far before me. Yet here there is no height, no depth, no forwards, no backwards. No words can express this never-changing state. Often in the agony of this sameness, I exclaim with violence, "Forever! Forever!" And this dark, incomprehensible word is clear and plain to the gloom of my condition. No ray of divinity illuminates this night. I shed all my tears by myself and for myself. Nothing is more horrible to me than friendship and love, for they alone excite in me the wish that the apparitions which surround me might be real. But these two spectres also have arisen from the abyss to plague me, and at length to tear from me the precious consciousness of my existence, unearthly though it be." "You should hear him speak," continued the physician, "when in hours of confidence he thus alleviates his heart. I have listened to him often with the deepest feelings. When pressed by anything, and as it were compelled for an instant to confess that a space of time has passed, he looks astounded, then again refers the alteration to the things about him, considering it as an appearance of appearances, and so rejecting the idea of progress in duration. One night he sung a song about his grey hairs. We all sat round him weeping." "Oh, get it for me," cried Wilhelm. "But have you not discovered any trace of what he calls his crime?" inquired Jarno, "nor found out the reason of his wearing such a singular garb, of his conduct at the burning of the house, of his rage against the child?" "It is only by conjectures that we can approximate to any knowledge of his fate. To question him directly contradicts our principle. Observing easily that he was of the Catholic religion, we thought perhaps confession might afford him some assuagement. but he shrinks away with the strangest gestures every time we try to introduce the priest to him. However, not to leave your curiosity respecting him entirely unsatisfied, I may communicate our suppositions on the subject. In his youth we think he must have been a clergyman, hence probably his wish to keep his beard and long cloak. The joys of love appear to have remained for many years unknown to him. Late in life, as we conceive, some aberration with a lady very nearly related to him. Then her death, the consequence of an unlucky creature's birth, have altogether crazed his brain. His chief delusion is a fancy that he brings misfortune everywhere along with him, and that death, to be unwittingly occasioned by a boy, is constantly impending over him. At first he was afraid of Mignon, not knowing that she was a girl. Then Felix frightened him, and as with all his misery he has a boundless love of life, this may perhaps have been the origin of his aversion to the child. "What hopes have you of his recovery?" inquired our friend. "It advances slowly," answered the physician. "Yet it does advance. He continues his appointed occupations. We have now accustomed him to read the newspapers. He always looks for them with eagerness." "I am curious about his songs," said Jarno. "Of these I can engage to get you several," replied the doctor. "Our parson's eldest son, who frequently writes down his father's sermons, has, unnoticed by the harper, marked on paper many stanzas of his singing, out of which some songs have gradually been pieced together." Next morning Jarno met our friend and said to him, "We have to ask a kindness of you. Lydia must for some time be removed. Her violent, unreasonable love and passionateness hinder the Baron's recovery. His wound requires rest and calmness, though with his healthy temperament it is not dangerous. You see how Lydia tortures him with her tempestuous anxieties, her ungovernable terrors, her never-drying tears, and—" "Enough," he added with a smile, after pausing for a moment. "Our doctor expressly requires that she must quit us for a while. We have got her to believe that a lady, one of her most intimate friends, is at present in the neighbourhood, wishing and expecting instantly to see her. She has been prevailed upon to undertake a journey to our lawyer's, which is but 2 leagues off. This man is in the secret. He will woefully lament that Fräulein Teresa should have just left him again. He will seem to think she may still be overtaken. Lydia will hasten after her, and if you prosper, will be led from place to place. At last, if she insist on turning back, you must not contradict her. But the knight will help you. The coachman is a cunning knave, and we shall speak with him before he goes. You are to travel with her in the coach, to talk to her, and manage the adventure." "It is a strange and dubious commission that you give me," answered Wilhelm. "How painful is the sight of true love injured, and I am to be the instrument of injuring it. I have never cheated any person so, for it has always seemed to me that if we once begin deceiving with a view to good and useful purposes, we run the risk of carrying it to excess." "Yet you cannot manage children otherwise," said Jarno. "With children it may do," said Wilhelm, "for we love them tenderly, and take an open charge of them. But with our equals, in behalf of whom our heart is not so sure to call upon us for forbearance, it might frequently be dangerous. Yet do not think," he added, after pausing for a moment, "that I purpose to decline the task on this account. Honouring your judgment as I do, feeling such attachment to your noble friend, such eagerness to forward his recovery by whatever means, I willingly forget myself and my opinions. It is not enough that we can risk our life to serve a friend. In the hour of need we should also yield him our convictions. Our dearest passions, our best wishes, we are bound to sacrifice in helping him. I undertake the charge, though it is easy to foresee the pain I shall have to suffer from the tears, from the despair of Lydia." "And for this no small reward awaits you," answered Jarno. "Fräulein Teresa, whom you get acquainted with, is a lady such as you will rarely see. She puts many a man to shame. I may say she is a genuine Amazon, while others are but pretty counterfeits that wander up and down the world in that ambiguous dress." Wilhelm was struck. He almost fancied that in Teresa he would find his Amazon again, especially as Jarno, whom he importuned to tell him more, broke off abruptly and went away. The new, near hope of once more seeing that beloved and honoured being awoke 1,000 feelings in his heart. He now looked upon the task which had been given him as the intervention of a special providence. The thought that he was minded treacherously to carry off a helpless girl from the object of her sincerest, warmest love dwelt but a moment in his mind, as the shadow of a bird flits over the sunshiny earth. The coach was at the door. Lydia lingered for a moment as she was about to mount. "Salute your lord again for me," said she to the old servant. "Tell him that I shall be home before night." Tears were standing in her eyes as she again looked back when the carriage started. She then turned round to Wilhelm, made an effort to compose herself, and said, "In Fräulein Therese you will find a very interesting person. I wonder what it is that brings her hither. For, you must know, Lothario and she once passionately loved each other. In spite of the distance, he often used to visit her. I was staying with her then. I thought they would have lived and died for one another. But all at once it went to wreck. No creature could discover why. He had seen me, and I must confess that I was envious of Teresa's fortune, that I scarcely hid my love from him, that when he suddenly appeared to choose me in her stead, I could not but accept of him. She behaved to me beyond my wishes, though it almost seemed as if I had robbed her of this precious lover. But ah, how many thousand tears and pains that love of his has cost me! At first we met only now and then, and by stealth, at some appointed place. But I could not long endure that kind of life. In his presence only I was happy, wholly happy. Far from him my eyes were never dry, my pulse was never calm. Once he stayed away for several days. I was altogether in despair. I ordered out my carriage and surprised him here. He received me tenderly, and had not this unlucky quarrel happened, I should have led a heavenly life with him. But since the time he began to be in danger and in pain, I shall not say what I have suffered. At this moment I am bitterly reproaching myself that I could leave him for a single day." Wilhelm was proceeding to inquire about Teresa when they reached the lawyer's house. This gentleman came forward to the coach, lamenting woefully that Fräulein Teresa was already gone. He invited them to breakfast, signifying, however, that the lady might be overtaken in the nearest village. They determined upon following her. The coachman did not loiter. They had soon passed several villages and yet come up with nobody. Lydia now gave orders for returning. The coachman drove along, as if he did not understand her. As she insisted with redoubled vehemence, Wilhelm called to him and gave the promised token. The coachman answered that it was not necessary to go back by the same road. He knew a shorter and at the same time greatly easier one. He turned aside across a wood and over large commons. At last, no object that they could recognize appearing, he confessed that unfortunately he had lost his way, declaring at the same time that he would soon get right again, as he saw a little town before him. Night came on. The coachman managed so discreetly that he asked everywhere, and nowhere waited for an answer. He drove along all night. Lydia never closed an eye. In the moonshine she was constantly detecting similarities, which as constantly turned out to be dissimilar. In the morning things around seemed known to her, and but more strange on that account. The coach drew up before a neat little country house. A young lady stepped out and opened the carriage door. Lydia looked at her with a stare of wonder, looked round, looked at her again, and fainted in the arms of Wilhelm. Chapter 5. Wilhelm was conducted to a little upper room. The house was new, as small nearly as it could be, and extremely orderly and clean. In Teresa, who had welcomed him and Lydia at the coach, he had not found his Amazon. She was another and an altogether different woman. Handsome, and but of middle stature, she moved about with great alertness, and it seemed as if her clear, blue, open eyes let nothing that occurred escape them. She entered Wilhelm's room, inquiring if he wanted anything. "Pardon me," said she, "for having lodged you in a chamber which the smell of paint still renders disagreeable. My little dwelling is but just made ready. You are hand-selling this room, which is appointed for my guests. Would that you had come on some more pleasant errand. Poor Lydia is like to be a dull companion. In other points also you will have much to pardon. My cook has run away from me, at this unseasonable time, and a serving-man has bruised his hand. The case might happen I had to manage everything myself, and if it were so, why then we should just put up with it. One is plagued so with nobody as with one's servants. None of them will serve you, scarcely even serve himself." She said a good deal more on different matters. In general she seemed to like speaking. Wilhelm inquired for Lydia, if he might not see her, and endeavour to excuse himself. "It will have no effect at present," said Teresa. "Time excuses as it comforts. Words in both cases are of little effect. Lydia will not see you. Keep him from my sight," she cried when I was leaving her. "I could almost despair of human nature. Such an honourable countenance, so frank a manner, and this secret guile. Lothario she has quite forgiven. In a letter to the poor girl he declares, "My friends persuaded me, my friends compelled me." Among these she reckons you, and she condemns you with the rest.
"She does me too much honour in so blaming me," said Wilhelm. "I have no pretension to the friendship of that noble gentleman. On this occasion I am but a guiltless instrument. I will not praise what I have done. It is enough that I could do it. It concerned the health, it concerned the life, of a man whom I value more than any one I ever knew before. Oh, what a man is he, Fräulein! And what men are they that live about him? In their society, I, for the first time, I may well say, carried on a conversation. For the first time was the inmost sense of my words returned to me, more rich, more full, more comprehensive, from another's mouth. What I had been groping for was rendered clear to me, what I had been thinking I was taught to see. Unfortunately, this enjoyment was disturbed, at first by numerous anxieties and whims, and then by this unpleasant task. I undertook it with submission, for I reckoned it my duty, even though I sacrificed my feelings, to comply with the request of this gifted company of men." While he spoke, Teresa had been looking at him with a very friendly air. Oh, how sweet is it to hear one's own opinion uttered by a stranger tongue! We are never properly ourselves until another thinks entirely as we do. My own opinion of Lothario is perfectly the same as yours. It is not every one that does him justice, and therefore all that know him better are enthusiastic in esteem of him. The painful sentiment that mingles with the memory of him in my heart cannot hinder me from thinking of him daily. A sigh heaved her bosom as she spoke thus, and a lovely tear glittered in her right eye. "Think not," continued she, "that I am so weak, so easy to be moved. It is but the eye that weeps. There was a little wart upon the under eyelid. They have happily removed it, but the eye has been weak ever since. The smallest cause brings a tear into it. Here sat the little wart. You cannot see a vestige of it now." He saw no vestige, but he saw into her eye. It was clear as crystal. He almost imagined he could see to the very bottom of her soul. "We have now," said she, "pronounced the watchword of our friendship. Let us get entirely acquainted as fast as possible. The history of every person paints his character. I will tell you what my life has been. Do you, too, place a little trust in me, and let us be united even when the distance parts us. The world is so waste and empty, when we figure only towns and hills and rivers in it. But to know of someone here and there whom we accord with, who is living on with us, even in silence, this makes our earthly ball a peopled garden." She hastened off, engaging soon to take him out to walk. Her presence had affected him agreeably. He wished to be informed of her relation to Lothario. He was called. She came to meet him from her room. While they descended necessarily one by one, the straight and even steepish stairs, she said, "All this might have been larger and grander had I chosen to accept the office of your generous friend. But to continue worthy of him, I must study to retain the qualities which gave me merit in his eyes. Where is the steward?" asked she, stepping from the bottom of the stairs. "You must not think," continued she, "that I am rich enough to need a steward. The few acres of my own little property I myself can manage well enough. The steward is my new neighbour's, who has bought a fine estate beside us, every point of which I am acquainted with. The good old gentleman is lying ill of gout. His men are strangers here. I willingly assist in settling them." They took a walk through fields, meadows, and some orchards. Everywhere Teresa kept instructing the steward. Nothing so minute but she could give account of it. And Wilhelm had reason to wonder at her knowledge, her precision, the prompt dexterity with which she suggested means for ends. She loitered nowhere, always hastened to the leading points, and thus her task was quickly over. "Salute your master," said she as she sent away the man. "I mean to visit him as soon as possible and wish him a complete recovery. There now," she added with a smile as soon as he was gone, "I might soon be rich. My good neighbour, I believe, would not be disinclined to offer me his hand." "The old man with the gout," cried Wilhelm. "I know not how, at your years, you could bring yourself to make so desperate a determination." "Nor am I tempted to it," said Teresa. "Whoever can administer what he possesses has enough, and to be wealthy is a burdensome affair, unless you understand it." Wilhelm testified his admiration at her skill in husbandry concerns. Decided inclination, early opportunity, external impulse, and continued occupation in a useful business, said she, make many things, which were at first far harder, possible in life.
When you have learned what causes stimulated me in this pursuit, you will cease to wonder at the talent you now think strange." On returning home, she sent him to her little garden. Here he could scarcely turn himself, so narrow were the walks, so thickly was it sown and planted. On looking over to the court, he could not help smiling. The firewood was lying there, as accurately sawed, split, and piled, as if it had been part of the building, and had been intended to continue permanently there. The tubs and implements, all clean, were standing in their places. The house was painted white and red. It was really pleasant to behold. Whatever can be done by handicraft, which knows not beautiful proportions, but labours for convenience, cheerfulness, and durability, appeared united in this spot. They served him up dinner in his own room. He had time enough for meditating. Especially it struck him that he should have got acquainted with another person of so interesting a character, who had been so closely related to Lothario. "It is just," said he to himself, "that a man so gifted should attract round him gifted women. How far the influence of manliness and dignity extends! Would that others did not come so woefully short compared with him! Yes, confess thy fear. When thou meetest with thy Amazon, this woman of women, in spite of all thy hopes and dreaming, thou wilt find her, in the end, to thy humiliation and thy shame, his bride." End of section 7. Section 8 of Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Volume 2, by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, translated by Thomas Carlyle. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Book 7, Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Chapter 6. Wilhelm had passed a restless afternoon, not altogether without tedium, when toward evening his door opened, and a handsome hunter boy stepped forward with a bow. "Shall we have a walk?" said the youth, and in the instant Wilhelm recognised Teresa by her lovely eyes. "Pardon me this masquerade," said she, "for now, alas, it is nothing more. But as I am going to tell you of the time when I so enjoyed the world, I will recall those days by every method to my fancy. Come along. Even the place where we have rested so often from our hunts and promenades shall help me." They went accordingly. On their way Teresa said to her attendant, "It is not fair that I alone should speak. You already know enough of me, I nothing about you. Tell me, in the meanwhile, something of yourself, that I may gather courage to submit to you my history and situation." "Alas," said Wilhelm, "I have nothing to relate but error on the back of error, deviation following deviation, and I know none from whom I would more gladly hide my present and my past embarrassments than from yourself. Your look, the scene you move in, your whole temperament and manner, prove to me that you have reason to rejoice in your bygone life, that you have travelled by a fair, clear path in constant progress, that you have lost no time, that you have nothing to reproach yourself withal." Teresa answered with a smile, "Let us see if you will think so after you have heard my history." They walked along. Among some general remarks, Teresa asked him, "Are you free?" "I think I am," said he, "and yet I do not wish it." "Good," said she, "that indicates a complicated story. You also will have something to relate." Conversing thus, they ascended the hill and placed themselves beside a lofty oak, which spread its shade far out on every side. "Here," said she, "beneath this German tree, will I disclose to you the history of a German maiden. Listen to me patiently. My father was a wealthy nobleman of this province, a cheerful, clear-sighted, active, able man, a tender father, an upright friend, an excellent economist. I knew but one fault in him. He was too compliant to a wife who did not know his worth. Alas that I should have to say so of my mother. Her nature was the opposite of his. She was quick and changeful, without affection either for her home or for me, her only child. Extravagant, but beautiful, sprightly, full of talent, the delight of a circle she had gathered round her. Her society, in truth, was never large, nor did it long continue the same. It consisted principally of men, for no woman could like to be near her. Still less could she endure the merit or the praise of any woman. I resembled my father both in form and disposition, as the duckling with its first footsteps seeks the water. So from my earliest youth the kitchen, the storeroom, the granaries, the fields were my selected element. Cleanliness and order in the house seemed, even while I was playing in it, to be my peculiar instinct, my peculiar object. This tendency gave my father pleasure, and he directed, step by step, my childish endeavour into the suitablest employments. On the contrary, my mother did not like me, and she never for a moment hid it. I waxed in stature. With my years increased, my turn for occupation, and my father's love to me. When we were by ourselves, when walking through the fields, when I was helping to examine his accounts, it was then I could see how glad he was. While gazing on his eyes, I felt as if I had been looking in upon myself, for it was in the eyes that I completely resembled him. But in the presence of my mother he lost this energy, this aspect. He excused me mildly when she blamed me unjustly and violently. He took my part, not as if he would protect me, but as if he would extenuate the demerit of my good qualities. To none of her caprices did he set himself in opposition. She began to be immensely taken with a passion for the stage. A theatre was soon got up, of men of all shapes and ages, crowding to display themselves along with her upon the boards. She had abundance. Of women, on the other hand, there was often a scarcity. Lydia, a pretty girl who had been brought up with me, and who promised from the first to be extremely beautiful, had to undertake the secondary parts. The mothers and the aunts were represented by an ancient chambermaid, while the leading heroines, lovers, and shepherdesses of every kind were seized on by my mother. I cannot tell you how ridiculous it seemed to me to see the people, every one of whom I knew full well, standing on their scaffold, and pretending after they had dressed themselves in other clothes to pass for something else than what they were. In my eyes they were never anything but Lydia and my mother, this baron and that secretary, whether they appeared as counts and princes or as peasants, and I could not understand how they meant to make me think that they were sad or happy, that they were indifferent or in love, liberal or avaricious, when I well knew the contrary to be the case. Accordingly I very seldom stayed among the audience. I always snuffed their candles, that I might not be entirely without employment. I prepared the supper, and next morning, before they rose, I used to have their wardrobe all sorted, which commonly the night before they had left in a chaotic state. To my mother this activity appeared quite proper, but her love I could not gain. She despised me, and I know for certain that she more than once exclaimed with bitterness, "If the mother could be as uncertain as the father, you would scarcely take this housemaid for my daughter." Such treatment, I confess, at length entirely estranged me from her. I viewed her conduct as the conduct of a person unconnected with me, and being used to watch our servants like a falcon, for this, be it said in passing, is the ground of all true housekeeping, the proceedings of my mother and her friends at the same time naturally forced themselves upon my observation. It was easy to perceive that she did not look on all men alike. I gave sharper heed, and soon found out that Lydia was her confidant, and had herself, by this opportunity, become acquainted with a passion which, from her earliest youth, she had so often represented. I was aware of all their meetings, but I held my tongue, hinting nothing to my father, whom I was afraid of troubling. At last, however, I was obliged to speak. Many of their enterprises could not be accomplished without corrupting the servants. These now began to grow refractory. They despised my father's regulations, disregarded my commands. The disorders which arose from this I could not tolerate. I discovered all, complained of all to my father. He listened to me calmly. "Good girl," replied he with a smile, "I know it all. Be quiet, bear it patiently, for it is on thy account alone that I endure it." I was not quiet. I had not patience. I in secret blamed my father, for I did not think that any reason should induce him to endure such things. I called for regularity from all the servants. I was bent on driving matters to extremity. My mother had been rich before her marriage, yet she squandered more than she had a right to, and this, as I observed, occasioned many conferences between my parents. For a long time the evil was not helped, till at last the passions of my mother brought it to a head. Her first gallant became unfaithful in a glaring manner. The house, the neighbourhood, her whole condition grew offensive to her. She insisted on removing to a different estate. There she was too solitary. She insisted on removing to the town. There she felt herself eclipsed among the crowd. Of much that passed between my father and her I know nothing. However, he at last determined, under stipulations which I did not learn, to consent that she should take a journey, which she had been meditating, to the south of France. We were now free. We lived as if in heaven. I do believe my father could not be a loser had he purchased her absence by a considerable sum. All our useless domestics were dismissed, and fortune seemed to smile on our undertakings. We had some extremely prosperous years. All things succeeded to our wish. But alas, this pleasing state was not of long continuance. Altogether unexpectedly, my father had a shock of palsy. It lamed his right side, and deprived him of the proper use of speech. We had to guess at everything that he required, for he never could pronounce the word that he intended. There were times when this was dreadfully afflicting to us. He would require expressly to be left alone with me. With earnest gestures he would signify that everyone should go away, and when we saw ourselves alone he could not speak the word he meant. His impatience mounted to the highest pitch. His situation touched me to the inmost heart. Thus much seemed certain. He had something which he wished to tell me, which especially concerned my interest. What longing did I feel to know it! At other times I could discover all things in his eyes, but now it was in vain. Even his eyes no longer spoke. Only this was clear. He wanted nothing, he desired nothing. He was striving to discover something to me, which unhappily I did not learn. His malady revisited him. He grew entirely inactive, incapable of motion, and a short time afterward he died. I know not how it had got rooted in my thoughts, that somewhere he had hid a treasure which he wished at death to leave me rather than my mother. I searched about for traces of it while he lived, but I could meet with none. At his death a seal was put on everything. I wrote to my mother, offering to continue in the house and manage for her. She refused, and I was obliged to leave the place. A mutual testament was now produced. It gave my mother the possession and the use of all, and I was left, at least throughout her life, dependent on her. It was now that I conceived I rightly understood my father's beckonings. I pitied him for having been so weak. He had let himself be forced to do unjustly to me even after he was dead. Certain of my friends maintained that it was little better than if he had disinherited me. They called upon me to attack the will by law, but this I never could resolve on doing. I reverenced my father's memory too much. I trusted in destiny. I trusted in myself. There was a lady in the neighbourhood possessed of large property, with whom I had always been on good terms. She gladly received me. I engaged to superintend her household, and ere long the task grew very easy to me. She lived regularly, she loved order in everything, and I faithfully assisted her in struggling with her steward and domestics. I am neither of a niggardly nor grudging temper, but we women are disposed to insist, more earnestly than men, that nothing shall be wasted. Embezzlement of all sorts is intolerable to us. We require that each enjoy exactly in so far as right entitles him. Here I was in my element once more. I mourned my father's death in silence. My protectress was content with me. One small circumstance alone disturbed my peace. Lydia returned. My mother had been harsh enough to cast the poor girl off, after having altogether spoiled her. Lydia had learned with her mistress to consider passions as her occupation. She was wont to curb herself in nothing. On her unexpected reappearance, the lady whom I lived with took her in. She wished to help me, but could train herself to nothing. About this time the relatives and future heirs of my protectress often visited the house, to recreate themselves with hunting. Lothario was frequently among them. It was not long till I had noticed, though without the smallest reference to myself, how far he was superior to the rest. He was courteous toward all, and Lydia seemed ere long to have attracted his attention to her. Constantly engaged in something, I was seldom with the company. While he was there I did not talk so much as usual, for, I will confess it, lively conversation, from of old, had been to me the finest season of existence. With my father I was wont to talk of everything that happened. What you do not speak of you will seldom accurately think of. No man had I ever heard with greater pleasure than I did Lothario, when he told us of his travels and campaigns. The world appeared to lie before him clear and open, as to me the district was in which I lived and managed. We were not entertained with marvellous personal adventures, the extravagant half-truths of a shallow traveller, who was always painting out himself, and not the country he has undertaken to describe. Lothario did not tell us his adventures. He led us to the place itself. I have seldom felt so pure a satisfaction. But still higher was my pleasure when I heard him talk one evening about women. The subject happened to be introduced. Some ladies of the neighbourhood had come to see us, and were speaking in the common style about the cultivation of the female mind. Our sex, they said, was treated unjustly. Every sort of higher education men insisted on retaining for themselves.
They admitted us to no science. They required us either to be dolls or family drudges. To all this Lothario said not much, but when the party was a little thinned, he gave us his opinion more explicitly. "It is very strange," cried he, "that men are blamed for their proceedings here. They have placed woman on the highest station she is capable of occupying. And where is there any station higher than the ordering of the house? While the husband has to vex himself with outward matters, while he has wealth to gather and secure, while perhaps he takes part in the administration of the state, and everywhere depends on circumstances, ruling nothing, I may say, while he conceives that he is ruling much, compelled to be but politic where he would willingly be reasonable, to dissemble where he would be open, to be false where he would be upright, while thus, for the sake of an object which he never reaches, he must every moment sacrifice the first of objects, harmony with himself. A reasonable housewife is actually governing in the interior of her family, has the comfort and activity of every person in it to provide for and make possible. What is the highest happiness of mortals, if not to execute what we consider right and good, to be really masters of the means conducive to our aims? And where should or can our nearest aims be but in the interior of our home? All those indispensable and still to be renewed supplies, where do we expect, do we require, to find them, if not in the place where we rise and where we go to sleep, where kitchen and cellar and every species of accommodation for ourselves and ours is to be always ready? What unvarying activity is needed to conduct this constantly recurring series in unbroken living order? How few are the men to whom it is given to return regularly like a star, to command their day as they command their night, to form for themselves their household instruments, to sow and to reap, to gain and to expand, and to travel round their circle with perpetual success and peace and love? It is when a woman has attained this inward mastery that she truly makes the husband whom she loves a master. Her attention will acquire all sorts of knowledge. Her activity will turn them all to profit. Thus is she dependent upon no one, and she procures her husband genuine independence, that which is interior and domestic. Whatever he possesses, he beholds secured. What he earns, well employed. And thus he can direct his mind to lofty objects. And if fortune favours, he may act in the state the same character which so well becomes his wife at home. He then described to us the kind of wife he wished. I reddened, for he was describing me as I looked and lived. I silently enjoyed my triumph, and the more as I perceived from all the circumstances that he had not meant me individually, that indeed he did not know me. I cannot recollect a more delightful feeling in my life than this, when a man whom I so highly valued gave the preference, not to my person, but to my inmost nature. What a recompense did I consider it! What encouragement did it afford me! So soon as they were gone, my worthy benefactress with a smile observed to me, "Pity that men often think and speak of what they will never execute, else here were a special match, the exact thing for my dear Teresa." I made sport of her remark, and added that indeed men's understanding gave its vote for household wives, but that their heart and imagination longed for other qualities, and that we household people could not stand a rivalry with beautiful and lovely women. This was spoken for the ear of Lydia. She did not hide from us that Lothario had made a deep impression on her heart, and in reality he seemed at each new visit to grow more and more attentive to her. She was poor and not of rank. She could not think of marriage, but she was unable to resist the dear delight of charming and of being charmed. I had never loved, nor did I love at present, but though it was unspeakably agreeable to see in what light my turn of mind was viewed, how high it was ranked by such a man, I will confess I still was not altogether satisfied. I now wished that he should be acquainted with me, and should take a personal interest in me. This wish arose without the smallest settled thought of anything that could result from it. The greatest service I did my benefactress was in bringing into order the extensive forests which belonged to her. In this precious property, whose value time and circumstances were continually increasing, matters still went on according to the old routine, without regularity, without plan, no end to theft and fraud. Many hills were standing bare, and equal growth was nowhere to be found but in the oldest cuttings. I personally visited the whole of them, with an experienced forester. I got the woods correctly measured. I set men to hew, to sow, to plant. In a short time all things were in progress, that I might mount more readily on horseback, and also walk on foot with less obstruction. I had a suit of men's clothes made for me. I was present in many places. I was feared in all.
Hearing that our young friends with Lothario were purposing to have another hunt, it came into my head, for the first time in my life, to make a figure, or, that I may not do myself injustice, to pass in the eyes of this noble gentleman for what I was. I put on my men's clothes, took my gun upon my shoulder, and went forward with our hunters to await the party on our marches. They came. Lothario did not know me. A nephew of the lady introduced me to him as a clever forester, joked about my youth, and carried on his jesting in my praise, till at last Lothario recognized me. The nephew seconded my project, as if we had concocted it together. He circumstantially and gratefully described what I had done for the estates of his aunt, and consequently for himself. Lothario listened with attention. He talked with me, inquired concerning all particulars of the estates and district. I, of course, was glad to have such an opportunity of showing him my knowledge. I stood my ordeal very well. I submitted certain projects of improvement to him, which he sanctioned, telling me of similar examples, and strengthening my arguments by the connection which he gave them. My satisfaction grew more perfect every moment. Happily, however, I merely wished that he should be acquainted with me, not that he should love me. We came home, and I observed more clearly than before that the attention he showed Lydia seemed expressive of a secret attachment. I had reached my object, yet I was not at rest. From that day he showed a true respect for me, a fine trust in me. In company he usually spoke to me, asked my opinion, and appeared to be persuaded that, in household matters, nothing was unknown to me. His sympathy excited me extremely. Even when the conversation was of general finance and political economy, he used to lead me to take part in it. And in his absence I endeavoured to acquire more knowledge of our province, nay, of all the empire. The task was easy for me. It was but repeating on the great scale what I knew so accurately on the small. From this period he visited our house oftener. We talked, I may say, of everything. Yet in some degree our conversation always in the end grew economical, if even but in a secondary sense. What immense effects a man, by the continuous application of his powers, his time, his money, even by means which seem but small, may bring about, was frequently and largely spoken of. I did not withstand the tendency which drew me toward him, and alas, I felt too soon how deep, how cordial, how pure and genuine was my love, as I believed it more and more apparent that Lydia, and not myself, was the occasion of these visits. She, at least, was most vividly persuaded so. She made me her confidant, and this again in some degree consoled me. For in truth what she explained so much to her advantage I reckoned nowise of importance. There was not a trace of any serious lasting union being meditated, but the more distinctly did I see the wish of the impassioned girl to be his at any price. Thus did matters stand when the lady of the house surprised me with an unexpected message. "Lothario," said she, "offers you his hand, and desires through life to have you ever at his side." She enlarged upon my qualities, and told me, what I liked sufficiently to hear, that in me Lothario was persuaded he had found the person whom he had so long been seeking for. The height of happiness was now attained for me. My hand was asked by a man for whom I had the greatest value, beside whom, and along with whom, I might expect a full, expanded, free, and profitable employment of my inborn tendency, of my talent perfected by practice. The sum of my existence seemed to have enlarged itself into infinitude. I gave my consent. He himself came and spoke with me in private. He held out his hand to me. He looked into my eyes. He clasped me in his arms and pressed a kiss upon my lips. It was the first and the last. He confided to me all his circumstances, told me how much his American campaign had cost him, what debts he had accumulated on his property, that on this score he had in some measure quarrelled with his granduncle, that the worthy gentleman intended to relieve him, though truly in his own peculiar way, being minded to provide him with a rich wife, whereas a man of sense would choose a household wife at all events, that, however, by his sister's influence, he hoped his noble relative would be persuaded. He set before me the condition of his fortune, his plans, his prospects, and requested my cooperation. Till his uncle should consent, our promise was to be a secret. Scarcely was he gone when Lydia asked me whether he had spoken of her. I answered no, and tired her with a long detail of economical affairs. She was restless, out of humour, and his conduct when he came again did not improve her situation. But the sun, I see, is bending to the place of rest. Well for you, my friend. You would otherwise have had to hear this story, which I often enough go over by myself, in all its most minute particulars. Let me hasten. We are coming to an epoch on which it is not good to linger. By Lothario I was made acquainted with his noble sister, and she at a convenient time contrived to introduce me to the uncle. I gained the old man. He consented to our wishes, and I returned with happy tidings to my benefactress. The affair was now no secret in the house. Lydia heard of it. She thought the thing impossible. When she could no longer doubt of it, she vanished all at once. We knew not whither she had gone. Our marriage day was coming near. I had often asked him for his portrait. Just as he was going off, I reminded him that he had promised it. He said, "You have never given me the case you want to have it fitted into." This was true. I had got a present from a female friend on which I set no ordinary value. Her name, worked from her own hair, was fastened on the outer glass. Within there was a vacant piece of ivory, on which her portrait was to have been painted, when a sudden death snatched her from me. Lothario's love had cheered me at the time her death lay heavy on my spirits, and I wished to have the void which she had left me in her present filled by the picture of my friend. I ran to my chamber, fetched my jewel-box, and opened it in his presence. Scarcely had he looked into it when he noticed a medallion with the portrait of a lady. He took it in his hand, considered it attentively, and asked me hastily whose face it was. "My mother's," answered I. "I could have sworn," said he, "that it was the portrait of a Madame Saint-Alban, whom I met some years ago in Switzerland." "It is the same," replied I, smiling, "and so you have unwittingly become acquainted with your stepmother. Saint-Alban is the name my mother has assumed for travelling with. She passes under it in France at present." "I am the miserablest man alive," exclaimed he, as he threw the portrait back into the box, covered his eyes with his hand, and hurried from the room. He sprang on horseback. I ran to the balcony and called out after him. He turned, waved his hand to me, went speedily away, and I have never seen him more. The sun went down. Teresa gazed with unaverted looks upon the splendour, and both her fine eyes filled with tears. Teresa spoke not. She laid her hand upon her new friend's hands. He kissed it with emotion. She dried her tears and rose. "Let us return and see that all is right," said she. The conversation was not lively, by the way. They entered the garden door and noticed Lydia sitting on a bench. She rose, withdrew before them, and walked in. She had a paper in her hand. Two little girls were by her. "I see," observed Teresa, "she is still carrying her only comfort, Lothario's letter, with her. He promises that she shall live with him again so soon as he is well. He begs of her till then to stay in peace with me. On these words she hangs, with these lines she solaces herself, but with his friends she is extremely angry." Meanwhile the two children had approached. They courtesied to Teresa, and gave her an account of all that had occurred while she was absent. "You see here another part of my employment," said Teresa. "Lothario's sister and I have made a league. We educate some little ones in common, such as promise to be lively, serviceable housewives I can take charge of, she of such as show a finer and more quiet talent. It is right to provide for the happiness of future husbands, both in household and in intellectual matters. When you become acquainted with my noble friend, a new era in your life will open. Her beauty, her goodness, make her worthy of the reverence of the world." Wilhelm did not venture to confess that unhappily the lovely countess was already known to him, that his transient connection with her would occasion him perpetual sorrow. He was well pleased that Teresa let the conversation drop, that some business called for her within. He was now alone. The intelligence which he had just received of the young and lovely countess being driven to replace, by deeds of benevolence, her own lost comfort, made him very sad. He felt that with her it was but a need of self-oblivion, an attempt to supply by the hopes of happiness to others, the want of a cheerful enjoyment of existence in herself. He thought Teresa happy, since, even in that unexpected melancholy alteration which had taken place in her prospects, there was no alteration needed in herself. "How fortunate beyond all others," cried he, "is the man who, in order to adjust himself to fate, is not required to cast away his whole preceding life." Teresa came into his room and begged pardon for disturbing him. "My whole library," said she, "is in the wall-press here. They are rather books which I do not throw aside than which I have taken up. Lydia wants a pious book. There are one or two of that sort among them. Persons who throughout the whole 12 months are worldly think it necessary to be godly at a time of straits. all moral and religious matters they regard as physic, which is to be taken with aversion when they are unwell. In a clergyman, a moralist, they see nothing but a doctor, whom they cannot soon enough get rid of. Now, I confess, I look upon religion as a kind of diet, which can only be so when I make a constant practice of it, when throughout the whole 12 months I never lose it out of sight. She searched among the books. She found some edifying works, as they are called. It was of my mother, said Teresa, that poor Lydia learned to have recourse to books like these. While her gallant continued faithful, plays and novels were her life. His departure brought religious writings once more into credit. I, for my share, cannot understand, continued she, how men have made themselves believe that God speaks to us through books and histories. The man to whom the universe does not reveal directly what relation it has to him, whose heart does not tell him what he owes to himself and others, that man will scarcely learn it out of books, which generally do little more than give our errors names. She left our friend alone. He passed his evening in examining the little library. It had in truth been gathered quite at random. Teresa, for the few days Wilhelm spent with her, continued still the same. She related to him at different times the consequence of that singular incident with great minuteness. Day and hour, place and name, were present to her memory. We shall here compress into a word or two so much of it as will be necessary for the information of our readers. The reason of Lothario's quick departure was, unhappily, too easy to explain. He had met Teresa's mother on her journey. Her charms attracted him. She was no niggard of them, and this luckless transitory aberration came at length to shut him out from being united to a lady whom nature seemed to have expressly made for him. As for Teresa, she continued in the pure circle of her duties. They learned that Lydia had been living in the neighbourhood in secret. She was happy that the marriage, though for unknown causes, had not been completed. She endeavoured to renew her intimacy with Lothario, and more, as it seemed, out of desperation than affection, by surprise than with consideration, from tedium than of purpose, he had met her wishes. Teresa was not uneasy on this account. She waived all further claims, and if he had even been her husband, she would probably have had sufficient spirit to endure a matter of this kind, if it had not troubled her domestic order. At least she often used to say that a wife who properly conducted her economy should take no umbrage at such little fancies of her husband, but be always certain that he would return. Ere long Teresa's mother had deranged her fortune. The losses fell upon the daughter, whose share of the effects in consequence was small. The old lady who had been Teresa's benefactress died, leaving her a little property in land and a handsome sum by way of legacy. Teresa soon contrived to make herself at home in this new narrow circle. Lothario offered her a better property, Jarno endeavouring to negotiate the business, but she refused it. I will show, said she, in this little that I deserved to share the great with him, but I keep this before me, that, should accident embarrass me, on my own account or that of others, I will betake myself without the smallest hesitation to my generous friend. There is nothing less liable to be concealed and unemployed than well-directed practical activity. Scarcely had she settled in her little property when her acquaintance and advice began to be desired by many of her neighbours, and the proprietor of the adjacent lands gave her plainly enough to understand that it depended on herself alone whether she would take his hand and be heiress of the greater part of his estates. She had already mentioned the matter to our friend. She often jested with him about marriages, suitable and unsuitable. Nothing, said she once, gives a greater loose to people's tongue than when a marriage happens which they can denominate unsuitable. And yet the unsuitable are far more common than the suitable. For alas, with most marriages it is not long till things assume a very piteous look. The confusion of ranks by marriage can be called unsuitable only when the one party is unable to participate in the manner of existence which is native, habitual, and which at length grows absolutely necessary to the other. The different classes have different ways of living, which they cannot change or communicate to one another. And this is the reason why connections such as these, in general, were better not to be formed. Yet exceptions and exceptions of the happiest kind are possible. Thus, too, the marriage of a young woman with a man advanced in life is generally unsuitable. Yet I have seen some such turn out extremely well. For me, I know but of one kind of marriage that would be entirely unsuitable, that in which I should be called upon to make a show and manage ceremonies. I would rather give my hand to the son of any honest farmer in the neighbourhood. Wilhelm at length made ready for returning. He
He requested of Teresa to obtain for him a parting word with Lydia. The impassioned girl at last consented. He said some kindly things to her, to which she answered, "The first burst of anguish I have conquered. Lothario will be ever dear to me. But for those friends of his I know them, and it grieves me that they are about him. The abbé, for a whim's sake, could leave a person in extreme need, or even plunge one into it. The doctor would have all things go on like clockwork. Yarno has no heart, and you, at least, no force of character. Just go on. Let these three people use you as their tool. They will have many an execution to commit to you. For a long time, as I know well, my presence has been hateful to them. I had not found out their secret, but I had observed that they had one. Why these bolted rooms, these strange passages? Why can no one ever reach the central tower? Why did they banish me, whenever they could, to my own chamber? I will confess, jealousy at first incited me to these discoveries. I feared some lucky rival might be hid there. I have now laid aside that suspicion. I am well convinced that Lothario loves me, that he means honourably by me, but I am quite as well convinced that his false and artful friends betray him. If you would really do him service, if you would ever be forgiven for the injury which I have suffered from you, free him from the hands of these men. But what am I expecting? Give this letter to him, repeat what it contains, that I will love him for ever, that I depend upon his word. Ah, cried she, rising and throwing herself with tears upon Teresa's neck, he is surrounded by my foes. They will endeavour to persuade him that I have sacrificed nothing for his sake. Oh, Lothario may well believe that he is worthy of any sacrifice, without needing to be grateful for it. Wilhelm's parting with Teresa was more cheerful. She wished they might soon meet again. Me you wholly know, said she. I alone have talked while we have been together. It will be your duty next time to repay my candour. During his return he kept contemplating this new and bright phenomenon with the liveliest recollection. What confidence had she inspired him with? He thought of Mignon and Felix, and how happy they might be if under her direction. Then he thought of himself, and felt what pleasure it would be to live beside a being so entirely serene and clear. As he approached Lothario's castle, he observed, with more than usual interest, the central tower and the many passages and side buildings. He resolved to question Yarno or the abbé on the subject by the earliest opportunity. Chapter 7. On arriving at the castle, Wilhelm found its noble owner in the way of full recovery. The doctor and the abbé had gone off. Yarno alone was there. It was not long till the patient now and then could ride, sometimes by himself, sometimes with his friends. His conversation was at once courteous and earnest, instructive and enlivening. You could often notice in it traces of a tender sensibility. Although he strove to hide it, and almost seemed to blame it, when in spite of him it came to view. One evening while at table he was silent, though his look was very cheerful. "Today," said Yarno, "you have met with an adventure, and no doubt you relished it." "I give you credit for your penetration," said Lothario. "Yes, I have met with a very pleasing adventure. At another time, perhaps, I should not have considered it so charming as today, when it came upon me so attractively. Toward night I rode out beyond the river, through the hamlets, by a path which I had often visited in former years. My bodily ailings must have reduced me more than I supposed. I felt weak, but as my strength was reawakening, I was, as it were, new-born. All objects seemed to wear the hues they had in earlier times. All looked graceful, lovely, charming, as they have not looked to me for many years. I easily observed that it was mere debility, yet I continued to enjoy it. I rode softly onward, and could now conceive how men may grow to like diseases which attune us to those sweet emotions. You know perhaps what used of old so frequently to lead me that way?" "If I mistake not," answered Yarno, "it was a little love concern you were engaged in with a farmer's daughter." "It might be called a great one," said Lothario, "for we loved each other deeply, seriously, and for a long time. Today, it happened, everything combined to represent before me in its liveliest colour the earliest season of our love. The boys were again shaking maybugs from the trees. The ashen grove had not grown larger since the day I saw her first. It was now long since I had met with Margaret. She is married at a distance, and I had heard by chance that she was come with her children some weeks ago to pay a visit to her father. This ride, then, was not altogether accidental?
I will not deny, replied Lothario, that I wished to meet her. On coming near the house, I saw her father sitting at the door. A child of probably a year old was standing by him. As I approached, a female gave a hasty look from an upper window, and a minute afterward I heard some person tripping downstairs. I thought surely it was she, and I will confess I was flattering myself that she had recognized me and was hastening to meet me. But what was my surprise and disappointment when she bounded from the door, seized the child, to whom the horses had come pretty close, and took it in. It gave me a painful twinge. My vanity, however, was a little solaced when I thought I saw a tint of redness on her neck and on the ear, which were uncovered. I drew up, and while speaking with the father, glanced sideways over all the windows to observe if she would not appear at some of them, but no trace of her was visible. Ask I would not, so I rode away. My displeasure was a little mollified by wonder. Though I had not seen the face, it appeared to me that she was scarcely changed, and 10 years are a pretty space. Nay, she looked even younger, quite as slim, as light of foot. Her neck, if possible, was lovelier than before, her cheeks as quick at blushing. Yet she was the mother of 6 children, perhaps of more. This apparition suited the enchantment which surrounded me so well that I rode along with feelings grown still younger. And I did not turn till I was at the forest, when the sun was going down. Strongly as the falling dew and the prescription of our doctor called upon me to proceed direct homewards, I could not help again going round by the farmhouse. I observed a woman walking up and down the garden, which is fenced by a light hedge. I rode along the footpath to it, and found myself at no great distance from the person whom I wanted. Though the evening sun was glancing in my eyes, I saw that she was busy with the hedge, which only slightly covered her. I thought I recognized my mistress. On coming up, I halted, not without a palpitation at the heart. Some high twigs of wild roses, which a soft air was blowing to and fro, made her figure indistinct to me. I spoke to her, asked her how she was. She answered in an undertone, "Quite well." In the meantime, I perceived a child behind the hedge, engaged in plucking roses, and I took the opportunity of asking where her other children were. "It is not my child," said she. "That were rather early." And at this moment it happened that the twigs were blown aside, and her face could be distinctly seen. I knew not what to make of the affair. It was my mistress, and it was not. Almost younger, almost lovelier than she used to be 10 years before. "Are you not the farmer's daughter?" inquired I, half confused. "No," said she, "I am her cousin." "You resemble one another wonderfully," added I. "Yes, so says everyone that knew her half a score of years ago." I continued putting various questions to her. My mistake was pleasant to me, even after I had found it out. I could not leave this living image of bygone blessedness that stood before me. The child, meanwhile, had gone away. It had wandered to the pond in search of flowers. She took her leave and hastened after it. I had now, however, learned that my former love was really in her father's house. While riding forward, I employed myself in guessing whether it had been her cousin or she that had secured the child from harm. I more than once, in thought, repeated all the circumstances of the incident. I can remember few things that have affected me more gratefully. But I feel that I am still unwell. We must ask the doctor to deliver us from the remains of this pathetic humour. With confidential narratives of pretty love adventures, it often happens as with ghost stories. When the first is told, the others follow of themselves. Our little party, in recalling other times, found numerous passages of this description. Lothario had the most to tell. Jarno's histories were all of one peculiar character. What Wilhelm could disclose we already know. He was apprehensive that they might mention his adventure with the Countess, but it was not hinted at, not even in the remotest manner. "It is true," observed Lothario, "there can scarcely any feeling in the world be more agreeable than when the heart, after a pause of indifference, again opens to love for some new object. Yet I would forever have renounced that happiness, had fate been pleased to unite me with Teresa. We are not always youths. We ought not always to be children. To the man who knows the world, who understands what he should do in it, what he should hope from it, nothing can be more desirable than meeting with a wife who will everywhere cooperate with him, who will everywhere prepare his way for him, whose diligence takes up what his must leave, whose occupation spreads itself on every side, while his must travel forward on its single path. What a heaven had I figured for myself beside Teresa! Not the heaven of an enthusiastic bliss, but of a sure life on earth. Order in prosperity, courage in adversity, care for the smallest, and a spirit capable of comprehending and managing the greatest. Oh, I saw in her the qualities which, when developed, make such women as we find in history, whose excellence appears to us far preferable to that of men. This clearness of view, this expertness in all emergencies, this sureness in details, which brings the whole so accurately out, although they never seem to think of it. You may well forgive me, added he, and turning to Wilhelm with a smile, that I forsook Aurelia for Teresa. With the one I could expect a calm and cheerful life, with the other not a happy hour. I will confess, said Wilhelm, that in coming hither I had no small anger in my heart against you, that I proposed to censure with severity your conduct to Aurelia. It was really censurable, said Lothario. I should not have exchanged my friendship for her with the sentiment of love. I should not, in place of the respect which she deserved, have intruded an attachment she was neither calculated to excite nor to maintain. Alas, she was not lovely when she loved, the greatest misery that can befall a woman. Well, it is past, said Wilhelm. We cannot always shun the things we blame. In spite of us, our feelings and our actions sometimes strangely swerve from their natural and right direction. Yet there are certain duties which we never should lose sight of. Peace be to the ashes of our friend. Without censuring ourselves or her, let us with sympathizing hearts strew flowers upon her grave. But at the grave in which the hapless mother sleeps, let me ask why you acknowledge not the child, a son whom any father might rejoice in, and whom you appear entirely to overlook. With your pure and tender nature, how can you altogether cast away the instinct of a parent? All this while you have not spent one syllable upon that precious creature, of whose attractions I could say so much. Whom do you speak of? Asked Lothario. I do not understand you. Of whom but of your son, Aurelia's son, the lovely child, to whose good fortune there is nothing wanting, but that a tender father should acknowledge and receive him. You mistake, my friend, exclaimed Lothario. Aurelia never had a son, at least by me. I know of no child, or I would with joy acknowledge it. And even in the present case I will gladly look upon the little creature as a relic of her, and take charge of educating it. But did she ever give you to believe that the boy was hers, was mine? I cannot recollect that I ever heard a word from her expressly on the subject, but we took it up so, and I never for a moment doubted it. I can give you something like a clue to this perplexity, said Jarno. An old woman, whom you must have noticed often, gave Aurelia the child. She accepted it with passion, hoping to alleviate her sorrows by its presence, and in truth it gave her many a comfortable hour. This discovery awoke anxieties in Wilhelm. He thought of his dear Mignon and his beautiful Felix with the liveliest distinctness. He expressed his wish to remove them both from the state in which they were. "We shall soon arrange it," said Lothario. "The little girl may be committed to Teresa. She cannot be in better hands. As for the boy, I think you should yourself take charge of him. What in us the women leave uncultivated, children cultivate when we retain them near us." "But first, I think," said Jarno, "you will once for all renounce the stage, as you have no talent for it." Our friend was struck. He had to curb himself, for Jarno's harsh sentence had not a little wounded his self-love. "If you convince me of that," replied he, forcing a smile, "you will do me a service, though it is but a mournful service to rouse one from a pleasing dream." "Without enlarging on the subject," answered Jarno, "I could merely wish you would go and fetch the children. The rest will come in course." "I am ready," answered Wilhelm. "I am restless and curious to see if I can get no further knowledge of the boy. I long to see the little girl who has attached herself so strangely to me." It was agreed that he should lose no time in setting out. Next day he had prepared himself. His horse was saddled. He only waited for Lothario to take leave of him. At the dinner hour they went as usual to table, not waiting for the master of the house. He did not come till late, and then sat down by them. "I could bet," said Jarno, "that today you have again been making trial of your tenderness of heart. You have not been able to withstand the curiosity to see your quondam love." "Guest," replied Lothario. "Let us hear," said Jarno, "how it went. I long to know." "I confess," replied Lothario, "the affair lay nearer my heart than it reasonably ought. So I formed the resolution of again riding out, and actually seeing the person whose renewed young image had affected me with such a pleasing illusion. I alighted at some distance from the house, and sent the horses to a side, that the children who were playing at the door might not be disturbed. I entered the house. By chance she met me just within the threshold. It was herself, and I recognized her, notwithstanding the striking change. She had grown stouter and seemed to be larger. Her gracefulness was shaded by a look of staidness. Her vivacity had passed into a calm reflectiveness. Her head, which she once bore so airily and freely, drooped a little. Slight furrows had been traced upon her brow. She cast down her eyes on seeing me, but no blush announced an inward movement of the heart. I held out my hand to her. She gave me hers. I inquired about her husband. He was absent. About her children, she stepped out and called them. All came in and gathered round her. Nothing is more charming than to see a mother with a child upon her arm. Nothing is more reverent than a mother among many children. That I might say something, I asked the name of the youngest. She desired me to walk in and see her father. I agreed. She introduced me to the room, where everything was standing almost just as I had left it. And what seemed stranger still, the fair cousin, her living image, was sitting on the very seat behind the spinning wheel, where I had found my love so often in the self-same form. A little girl, the very figure of her mother, had come after us. And thus I stood in the most curious scene, between the future and the past, as in a grove of oranges, where within a little circle flowers and fruits are living, in successive stages of their growth, beside each other. The cousin went away to fetch us some refreshment. I gave the woman I had loved so much my hand, and said to her, "I feel a true joy in seeing you again." "You are very good to say so," answered she, "but I also can assure you I feel the highest joy. How often have I wished to see you once more in my life? I have wished it in moments which I regarded as my last." She said this with a settled voice, without appearance of emotion, with that natural air which of old delighted me so much. The cousin returned, the father with her, and I leave you to conceive with what feelings I remained, and with what I came away. End of section 8.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.